Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1992, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1992, here from our perch in 2024. I am one of your hosts, Phil Lisko.
I am your other host, Emily. I'm your special guest host, Emily St. James, sitting in for your regular host, Food.
I really enjoyed that.
That's
one.
That's the best one.
That's the best one. Yeah, we've done this for a year and almost a half, and I feel like that's the best one. Food. With us today, writer director Chandler Levack is here to talk about Allison Anders' Gas Food Lodging. Chandler, I reached out to you a little while ago, and I was like, I'd love you to come on the podcast. You're very busy going to all these film festivals for your amazing film. I like movies. I didn't mean to be too effusive about it. I loved it. That's why I projected onto it. And hopefully it'll get down here to the United States so everyone can see your glorious film at some point, because it is a really, really wonderful movie.
Thank you.
Oh my God, please. But I reached out and I was really thankful you picked this film for a bunch of reasons. I think, first of all, I'm curious from a female writer director to talk about sort of Allison Anders and all that kind of stuff. But also, I kind of would be curious as to, you've seen this film before, correct? You had seen this film
before. No, this is my first.
Oh, wow. Time. Okay. Okay. So I'm actually kind of curious. I was watching it kind of through the lens of like your movie a little bit and seeing if there were sort of, because, you know, your film's an independent film as well. And there is sort of, I don't want to say necessarily similarities, because I don't think they're particularly similar films. But I did sort of see a little bit of the Fairuza Balk character. She could exist in a Chandler movie. Does that sound fair?
I mean, that's very generous to Fairuza Balk's beautiful performance in this movie, which I really want to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely.
I guess that character does really love going to the movies, if only to see, Hispanic melodramas.
Correct.
Less Todd Solondz happiness.
Correct.
But yeah, I mean, it feels like a pretty autobiographical kind of like hard on sleeve portrait of, a really specific coming of age experience and kind of an earnest love letter to cinema. But this movie is very, very female. Like, it feels like...
Yes. Your film is, I mean, your main protagonist is a teenage boy. So it obviously has, it's dissimilar in that regard. But I do think that, I don't know. I was watching this film. My perspective on this movie was that, as I've mentioned many times on the pod, I worked in a bunch of video stores in Toronto when I was growing up. And one of them was this video store called Videoflix, which was up by where I lived. And I got a job there when I was like 13, and they kind of like hired me under the table. And
oh,
I was
my
like,
God, you're confessing to crimes. What's the Canadian Internal Revenue Service? I'm emailing them this episode.
You should. They're in a business. So I think that it's all over.
I wouldn't get Jean-Christian on the horn.
Exactly. I was like a stock boy in the basement for like a few years until they could bring me up to to whatever. But
I'm a man.
Until I became a man. But I remember all of the people that worked there were, you know, between the ages of like 17 and 21 or something. And they all seemed super fucking cool and super old. And like they just had their fingers on the pulse. And I remember there were a lot of female co-workers there that loved this movie. Like they were always putting this movie on
in
the video store. Yeah, because you know how, and I don't mean to speak about video stores, but like, you know, you get staff picks, and you know how like when you're always kind of like banging a drum of a movie that you feel like doesn't get the love that it deserves.
Yeah.
And I think this was one of those like movies for a bunch of female coworkers, which I thought was interesting.
Oh, that is really interesting.
Yeah. Emily, you had not seen this film either, correct?
No, I hadn't. And you know, I liked it. I thought it was a good movie. I had a good time. That's the episode, everybody.
It was great. It's
giving it a little 82. I think it's
oh really? You're rating it? You're just telling me it's
okay. Phobia scale. It's like I think it's like a 2. You know, there's a little like yeah.
So what I was thinking from the Emily perspective as I was watching this film, mm-hmm. thinking to myself, what's Emily going to think? I thought about obviously one of your favorite films. Mm. Return to Oz, mm-hmm. starring Fairuza Balk.
Yep. Who's also she's also in The Craft, another movie that I'm
she
like,
was
yeah, yeah that's yeah.
I feel like my whole consciousness of Fairuza Balk like comes from The Craft. Yeah. And it's like yeah. she's just kind of like ready made on the screen as Nancy in The Craft. And it's actually insane to think of her as being like a young, whimsome little girl. And like,
yeah.
I'm almost like, while I was watching this movie, I was like, is Zooey Deschanel like our generation's Fairuza Balk? Like, it's such a.
I think they're like similar ages. So I think I think
Fairuza Balk. Almost famous.
Yeah.
Beautiful giant eyes.
Yeah. It's really weird because like I have loved Fairuza Balk in a lot of movies, but I've never been like she's never been one of my go-tos. I think it's because I don't want to like steal her aesthetic. I just don't think I'm gonna pull it off. It's not for me. But yeah, I you know what though, watching this put me in mind of when I was in between jobs back in the late 2000s during the great recession of the late 2000s.
Sure.
I had quit a job at a newspaper and my then parents, what a weird thing to say. My then parents were like, you know what? They sent me this very scathing email that was like, you quit this job. You never like applied yourself. You're going to be a failure, all this stuff. Sure. And I wrote a list of the 5 jobs I wanted to have. And number one was to like write for television, which now I do. Number two was to be a TV critic at the AV Club, which I did for a long time. Number three was to be an editor at a major newspaper, which I've done. Number four was to be president of the United States. Jury's out on that one. And number five was to own a small like interstate side cafe. And like genuinely, this is like a lifelong dream of mine has been like if all of this fails.
Sure. A diner on the side of the road.
Like Truckee, California, and buy a diner and just like make good food and just like feed tourists. So like this all kind of like
great. I mean, I think the president is probably the toughest gig to get. Of
that's
the ones
gonna be
that
hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know,
I'll vote for you, just to be clear.
Thank you. I do feel like 3 out of 5 isn't bad.
Yeah. And listen, my vote, I can vote now. So, you know, I actually could vote for you, just saying.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's that. This movie is a real, the movie that I kind of was thinking about as I was watching this was Passion Fish a little bit of like the John Sayles independent Americana kind of thing of very sort of slice of life. It's really interesting how, I mean, I was watching this thinking, like, could you make this movie today? And I actually think you could. Like, I do think there is a sort of, you know, a very small, maybe straight to streaming type version of this movie.
You don't think it's like a sleepy Amazon, you know, 6 episode.
Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. Probably it. That's probably the right. Yeah.
I think that pendulum has swung right back to indie film. I think it is like now the people aren't green lighting those sorts of series anymore. They're not, you know, Amazon's not green lighting I Love Dick, you know, which is like the TV show that comes to, which was a very fun show, but like
it was, yeah.
You know, they're not making that shit anymore. So it has kind of swung back to, you make this for, you know, $2 million with some of your friends, and you like somehow persuade James Brolin to be in it for 10 minutes, and like that's how you make your budget. But yeah, and then you bring it to Sundance. Like,
Millie Bobby Brown in the
Yeah.
Oh, that's so good. Yeah, let's do that.
Done. Yeah. But yeah. I think that, you know, obviously, Chandler, you did this to some extent recently, right? Which is you made a small independent film that did that had stunned the festival circuit and has been in. I do think that we're seeing a little bit more of the festivals actually being a petri dish, like actually getting these things picked up to some degree or another. They might take a while, but I feel like at one point or another, these movies are going to kind of, like, for instance, I went to see Fitting In recently, a movie that you recommended to me, which was amazing and loved.
Yeah, my friend.
And got a very brief theatrical release, but it did get a theatrical release. And I think that hopefully, you know, lots of goodwill will come to when it eventually lands on a streamer or something like that. But I guess this is all just a long way of saying that I do think that these sort of grounded character pieces, where like this felt very Kelly Reichardt to me to some degree, right? Like I think that this still kind of gets made.
Yeah, well, I feel like this was like the air 90s kind of like festival Sundance movie, you know.
Yes.
And
yes,
at a time when you could actually like launch an entire career with a Sundance movie. And I think that also, like, when this movie came out at Sundance, she was dating Tarantino.
Yep.
And there's this incredible profile where it kind of chronicles the two of their relationship as they're dating. And Tarantino has this quote about how he's like, I love going to film festivals. I just go to film festivals based on like the kind of women that I want to have sex with. Like if you were into Swedish girls, you go to Switzerland. And then I remember Allison Anders had this incredible quote where she's like, yeah, it doesn't work that way for women. I just have menopausal women following me around. And I was like, girl, it's so true.
It's so funny because like this is, I mean, we were talking about this kind of very briefly
did
before Reservoir we got
Dogs out. Come out the same year as Gas Food Lodging. That's
it does. It does. Yep. Both 92.
So, I mean, it's like they're both like kind of beloved Sundance hits, but like one launches like an entire career and dynasty. And then the other one's kind of this sort of forgotten gem by this kind of like, you know, female auteur, but like who really never gained like a serious foothold in Hollywood. Like
my knowledge of Allison Anders is when I was working as a TV critic, I would go to the yearly Television Critics Association press tour.
Sure.
And her last couple films were Lifetime movies, which had panels there. And so she would be on these panels and inevitably like people around the room would be like, there's Alice, you know, she made some great movies. She's just really, I can't believe she's doing Lifetime now or whatever.
Wow.
And I had never seen any of her movies, and this is indeed the first one I've seen, but it is very much like she is kind of an example of in that period, you know, there wasn't room for a lot of voices like hers, and they tended to get sort of pushed out or pushed to the side unless they were like Jane Campion levels of talented.
Yeah. Totally. It's,
which also are kind of very masculine films. Like,
oh, yeah.
You know,
I think it's
Catherine Bigelow or
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'd even go one step farther and say, you know, obviously we did the 99 podcast for as long as we did. And, you know, Chandler, you were on when we talked about Guinevere. It was hard in 99. You know what I mean? You could be Kimberly Pierce and make Boys Don't Cry and still struggle to get movies made. You know, it's let's be real, it's still not easy by any means. It should be far easier. There should be far more of them made, and we are seeing thankfully some progress, but it's still one of those things. I'm looking at the, you know, this won the Best Director at the New York Film Critics Circle, National Society of Film Critics, Independent Spirit Awards for Best Screenplay, and Best Director. I mean,
I believe it won Best New Director at those, which is
had nominations for Best Screenplay, Best Director, didn't win those at the Independent.
But it was very much like, you know, in that bubble of, it's kind of like, I mean, Celine Song has seen more success with Past Lives, but it very much is that thing where like all the critics groups were like, here's a Best New Director award.
And
the Best Director award's going to go to like Scorsese or Nolan, and like Scorsese and Nolan are genius filmmakers. I don't want to take away from their talents, but it is kind of that too often women who make a great debut film get shoehorned into that award and then they just slowly go away.
Mm-hmm. Or like Charlotte Wells with After Sun last year.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm obviously a huge fan of After Sun and Past Lives, and I'm incredibly excited to see what they continue to do. I'm very curious about Celine Song's next film, which sounds like it's going to be interesting. Yeah. I'm very excited. I think that another thing that tends to happen, and this doesn't just happen with female directors, but you know, she pivoted into television relatively quickly, all things considered. She did a handful of episodes of Sex and the City in 99. She did The L Word and What About Brian? And, you know, just a bunch of, she did a Riverdale. You know, she just, listen, she's a working director. I get it. But it does feel as though watching this film, I was just really kind of taken with how really, really effective it was at sort of this piercing specificity of a lot of stuff in this movie that I really loved. It made me think a lot of Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. It had that kind of vibe to it as well, which I really loved. I'm going to give a little bit of context on this film for our listeners who might not have seen it. Sisters Shade, played by Fariza Balk and Trudy, played by Oney Sky, live in a remote New Mexico town with their mother, Nora, played by Brooke Adams, who waits tables at a nearby truck stop. The introspective Shade spends most of her time alone at the movies, while Trudy is more outgoing and rebellious behavior that leads to various flings. While both girls are restless and looking for romance, Shade also has hopes to play matchmaker and find a nice guy for a hardworking mother. Gas Food Lodging opened on Times July 10th, 1992, just right in that summer corridor where it could find a really big audience, up against A League of Their Own, Universal Soldier, Boomerang, Batman Returns, Sister Act, and of course the Mighty Ducks.
Wow.
I do think like this was the thing that used to happen a lot in the 90s and 2000s, was there would be indie films that would get released in the summer as deliberate counter programming, and like you'd go to your indie theater and like, you know, they'd have Gas Food Lodging and you know, Orlando's another one that came out in the summer. So they'd have these like, this slate of like slightly more challenging films that nonetheless were not like dour.
Yep.
And like that would be your summer indie slate. And like it sort of makes sense to me in that regard, I guess, because it is like, not like a movie that's going to make you like super depressed.
No, I mean, it's funny, just Past Lives is a perfect example of that movie came out in July, right? Like, it's not as though it's insane to imagine that. I think they expected Past Lives to probably be a bigger hit in theaters for all intents and purposes, and it obviously had legs and, you know, stayed in people's minds throughout the rest of the year, but still, like, to put this up against Batman Returns and A League of Their Own, and I mean, it's just you're asking for it to get killed. It makes $1.3 million on a $1.3 million budget, so it makes its money back.
That's insane. That's like a huge triumph.
And by the way, I bet it was a big video movie. I mean, at least it wasn't my
movie. Yeah. It, like, but that's the thing. I feel like it's the only, it really speaks to like the 1992 of it all and just sort of the cultural conditions that were set up for independent cinema to thrive and for a movie like this to actually have a sustained theatrical run and kind of build its audience over time and, you know, then be played on video and be part of that awards conversation. Like, I just feel like that doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah. I mean, this is, you know, we've talked about this a little bit in past episodes, but like, this is the type of movie that, you know, we've talked about the idea of a movie being able to have legs, Emily, on video cassette, right? That idea of a rental, of a thing that actually could have some sort of a life after being in theaters. And I do think that this is one of those sort of little movies that if you have a bunch of video store clerks banging the drum about it, a bunch of people will watch it. You know, I vividly remember, and again, not to get back into video store world, but this was back in the day where a video store has to buy a certain amount of copies of a video cassette. And they usually cost anywhere from like $80 to $100 per video cassette. That's why you actually have to make your money back on these movies. Unless it was a sell-through title, which is like, you know, a Jurassic Park or something like that, where it's $20 a pop. This is the type of movie where like a video store is taking a flyer by saying, we'll take two or three copies of this movie and hope that we can over time make that money back. It's just sort of an interesting, it's just a different time. I mean, it's just a different way of making money.
I'm looking at this movie is an adapted screenplay, and I'm looking at the adapted screenplay category that year. And you know what? This movie is better than at least two of those. And I haven't it's better than three of those. So okay. I haven't
What are the nominees?
Okay. So I haven't seen Enchanted April, but I'm just assuming it's boring. Like
I've never heard of that.
It was nominated for a bunch of awards. I assume we'll do an episode on it at some point, probably in April when we want to get Enchanted.
What's the movie about? What is Enchanted April?
It's about in April when people get enchanted, Phil. What more do you need? Let's make sure to pencil that in for April. We'll find a guest.
We'll find a time. Maybe that's just me and you. We'll just get enchanted together, Emily.
Oh, no, we're going to get Vice President Kamala Harris. She's going to get enchanted. Okay, so Howard's End wins. Great win. Great script.
Sure.
Then it's Enchanted April. Uh-huh. The Player is another great script. Okay. River Runs Through It.
No.
And Scent of a Woman.
Yeah.
Scent of a Woman is so bad.
Happy to put
it doesn't age well.
Happy to put Gas, Food, Lodging in over three of those. So
absolutely. I mean, I do think, you know, it's so funny because I feel like she was a big name. I don't know how to explain this other than the fact that like Alison Anders' name meant something in the early 90s. And I think she gets Four Rooms, which was, I guess, going to be a thing, even though it very much was not.
Maybe that was through her Tarantino.
It definitely was. Who did the other two of them? Do you know, Emily?
I looked this up. Yeah. It's Alexander Rockwell and Robert Rodriguez. So
who is Alexander Rockwell? I don't know that person.
Let's find out.
And Rockwell's brother. It is.
Is it?
He did In the Soup or something.
Yes. In the Soup. Okay. His career has,
that's amazing.
You look at his filmography and you're like, oh yeah, this guy definitely teaches filmmaking at some university somewhere. Cause every so often he just makes like another micro budgeted film and you're like, yes, he's teaching at Kentucky or something like that.
Here's the thing. I want to talk Four Rooms for a quick second here. Have you seen Four Rooms, Chandler?
No.
Of course. I was a product of the 90s, and you know, at any point, like someone who is Tarantino curious puts on Four Rooms. Because Alison Anders did the one, I think Ione Sky is like a naked topless vampire, like teen vampires. Yeah, okay, it's all coming back to me.
She has to retrieve her ingredient, which is semen, from various people. So she's like a vampire but for semen. Listen, all I know
sounds good.
Yeah, I'm in.
I remember, obviously, 1994, Pulp Fiction comes out, and then this movie, which again, in theory, I feel like this happens every generation to some degree or another, where you get like a New York Stories, you get a Four Rooms, you get a bunch of directors that are like, wouldn't it be fun if we just did a bunch of shorts that are kind of loosely connected to one another?
Je t'aime or whatever.
Paris Je t'aime, yeah.
Next, we need a millennial omnibus.
Listen, if you can make it happen, Chandler. Yeah. But it does seem like conceptually I get it, because why wouldn't you want to just hang out with a bunch of your director friends and all make a movie in the same location together? And like, you know, what could go wrong? They're just not good movies. It's just, they never work. Like, you might have a section here or there, but the chapter thing for movies doesn't work as well. Emily, what are your thoughts on omnibuses?
I don't really care for them. Actually, I like horror omnibuses. That is a format that works really well. because it, yeah, you get in and out in 10 minutes. You can do some good scares, you know, that can lift pretty easily out of a format like that. I am like sitting here thinking about if I was going to like pick four directors right now who are like within their first couple features, like what omnibus would I have them make and what would the theme be? Like, you know, inevitably I'm just like, well, we got to do something about Christmas. No, but no, like I do like I would I am thinking about how many exciting young directors right now are women of color. And I'm just like, let's just do that. Let's just that sounds great.
That
let's
sounds
have
great.
Four women of color make films about Christmas.
Oh my God. The thing about Four Rooms, though, is that as you alluded to, Chandler, coming off of Pulp Fiction, everyone was like, what's the next Tarantino thing, right? And he does this chapter in this movie, which doesn't do particularly well. It cost $4 million, it made $4 million. Like, you know, no one lost their shirts on it, but it wasn't really a thing. And then, ironically, he tries to do it again with Rodriguez with the Grindhouse thing, where they try to, like, force that down people's throats, and no one was really biting on that. Although, I guess some people have kinder retroactive thoughts about those movies. I don't know.
That was like a fun thing to do, to go see the like Grindhouse thing. Like it flopped. Like they couldn't quite get it to take off in the way they wanted it to. But I am not a person who loves that kind of exploitation filmmaking, but that was like a fun concept. And of course Death Proof has sort of like taken on a life of its own.
Yeah, it's kind of etched its way into people. There are a lot of people that ride for that movie now, and I don't hate it, but it's definitely probably my least favorite of his movies. But
it's kind of funny that you're like proving our point. Like we've already sidelined Allison Anders on our own podcast.
Well, I'm my point more than anything
to Tarantino. It's
well, no, I don't want to talk about Tarantino. I just feel like there is something interesting about the fact that it should also be said too. I really enjoyed this movie, and we're going to obviously get into, you know, more in detail about this film. But it is a quiet movie, right? Like it's not a noisy movie. No one's ears are being chopped off. It doesn't have like
a lot of screaming teenage girls.
But it's part of, I think, why I imagine she struggled a little bit, despite all of the acclaim that this film gets, to sort of break out. It's hard to break out off of a movie like this, I imagine. Right?
I think this is a coming out at exactly the wrong time. And I don't mean in the sense of like she should have released this in 1986, but sure. Like she should have released this in 1986, because 1992 is like this fulcrum point in the reception of mainstream independent American film, which is like suddenly everything has to be a genre exercise in some capacity if it's going to break out. And this is not that. This is very in the tradition of the early Soderbergh works, in the tradition of John Sayles, in the tradition of all these like icons of American independent film. And it just is coming out at a time when people are ready for this other thing.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, it almost has like kind of a Jim Jarmusch, like kind of quiet character study sort of vibe.
Yeah, and like John Sayles that I was referring to earlier, like that kind of vibe too.
Yeah, although I still feel like if you're talking about kind of a breakthrough movie, like this broke through as much as any kind of debut by like a female director could.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, the critics, I don't know, Emily, if you did any sort of contemporaneous reviews, but like there wasn't a ton. Ebert didn't review this, which I was actually a little surprised because he usually does review movies like this.
I wonder like if it was one of those things where I probably played Chicago, because a movie of this size would have played Chicago. If it made $1.3 million, it played Chicago.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, I wonder if it played mostly at the smaller theaters. Like he frequently would like not review everything in summer because of various festivals and vacations and stuff. And I wonder if this just fell. Maybe like just he famously never reviewed the Jurassic Park, The Lost World, because he was at Cannes. And he was like, you don't need to know what I think about this movie. And I and young Emily was like, but what do I think about this, Roger?
Tell me. Yeah. I mean, The Washington Post said, called this movie a great movie about making do. And The New York Times said there are subtly etched characters, effortlessly fine performances, and a moving story that is not easily forgotten. I think that was Janet Maslin that did the New York Times review. It's a little surprising to me that it didn't have a little bit more critical fanfare. These are pretty muted reviews that I was reading. So it's a little interesting. The other movie that it made me think about, Emily, that we have covered on this podcast is This Is My Life, the Nora mm-hmm. Ephron movie.
I yeah. love that movie.
Which is a great movie.
I love that
movie. Single mom, two daughters, just trying to make ends meet, that type of vibe. But yeah, just again, obviously a female writer director and that sort of just the struggles of being a woman. Like I hate to be just as sort of, you know, blunt as that, but it does feel like watching this film and seeing the different men in these women's lives, and I felt a tremendous amount of empathy for their situation.
You know, every so often, this is going to seem like a weird tangent, but I promise it's not. Every so often, James L. Brooks is like, I'm just going to take this person under my wing and I'm going to make them a household name. He did that with Cameron Crowe. He does that with Wes Anderson. He's got this little window in between where he's not working. He should have just picked up Allison Anders. She's so doing so much. Like, the thing about Allison Anders is the movies she made after this, just from all accounts, and I haven't seen them, maybe they're hidden masterpieces, just aren't as good. And she kind of like, I think a thing I find fascinating about her is how frequently she tries to like tell stories about the Mexican-American experience in the United States, which she grew up working class in Kentucky. So like maybe she was just like really surrounded by that. I'm not going to like cast aspersions on her. I just find that like really fascinating that like that was like where her follow-up feature to this was like, I'm going to tell that story finally. And it was like, I don't know that people, I think people were hungry for stories about women living outside of society's normal, the things you normally see in movie screens. And like, that's what this movie is. And it feels like she kind of drifted away from that. I don't want to tell her what she should have done, because I think she probably was doing wonderful things, but you know.
I'll say that the one movie that feels like it was her moment and people just didn't click with the movie was Grace of My Heart. You guys ever seen that movie?
Yeah, that's a fantastic film.
Which I hear is fantastic. The Leanda Douglas movie.
Yeah, she's like a singer-songwriter. She kind of enters like the Brill Building in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm. And I fucking love that subject matter, so I bet I would love that movie.
Truthfully, I bet I would too, but it comes out when I am 16 years old. And I'm probably just not really feeling it. It's produced by Scorsese. It's edited by Thelma Schoonmaker, one of the editors on that film. It felt like it had, you know, it was still independent. It's Gramercy, so it was sort of under Universal, but still. And I kind of feel like that was the project, right? Like, had that broken through in a bigger way, I imagine a whole kind of career probably would have been.
Yeah, crazy. That could have been like her Oscar, her Good Will Hunting.
Whatever. I mean, even just like the movie made $600,000. I mean, like it made half of what this movie made.
Wow.
Well, did you cover her film Sugartown for 99? Did you ever? Yeah.
We didn't.
A movie is so obscure that I'm looking at its IMDb page, and you know the trailer that auto plays when you're playing? Mm-hmm. It's for a different thing called Sugartown. true crime documentary called that. It's like, this is what you're looking for, right?
Yeah, I've never heard that movie before.
I do feel like, and you know what, I am going to watch Grace of My Heart just for what it's worth, because I feel like I should, and I want to. But I do feel like it was kind of a 1-2 punch. It was also a moment when Ileana Douglas was given a lead role in a movie. Right. Yeah. I remember seeing her in To Die For in 95, the year before, I believe. And that was when I was just like, who's that? She's awesome. Yeah. And then obviously she's done lots of character work since. But like hanging a whole film on her, I think, was also sort of like a big moment.
Mm-hmm. She's playing a teenager in that movie. I do not feel that Ileana Douglas has ever been a teenager.
Been a feisty 30-year-old.
I'm looking at the reviews of this movie and they're very kind. It has a 79% on Grace of My Heart, to be clear. It has a 79% on Rotten Tomatoes, but it's very much like, it's one of those movies that just kind of slipped through the cracks.
Yeah. But I think that that's sort of a fulcrum point. You know what I mean? Like that's a moment when, and then shortly thereafter, she's in TV land and that's kind of what she's doing. But,
well, I feel like that's the story with so many female directors of his time, like Amy Heckerling.
Yes.
Patricia Rosema to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. Like you can name a whole bunch of them, these kind of women that had these really critically lauded debuts. Oh no, is this my future? And then
not your future.
You know,
I'm not gonna let it be your future.
Maybe if they're lucky, they get to make one or two follow-ups, but they never really gain traction or momentum, and then they just kind of get sidelined into TV, and then that's like they never make another movie again.
I was thinking about I think a similar career you see coming out of the 90s is Casey Lemons, who Eve's Bayou, fantastic movie. Gets so many great reviews, like has this like huge critical reception, and then like kind of bombs, and then she like doesn't make a movie for years and years and years. It's just this it was such a harsh landscape for
or the woman who made Love and Basketball.
Oh yeah,
Gina Prince-Bythewood,
and she's she's like carved out a career, but it took her a long time.
Cheryl Dunier, who made The Watermelon Woman. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's like so many like Sundance revered, you know, female auteurs that have that one breakout. And
then it's also like Corinne Kusama, who you know,
sure.
My close personal friend.
Your bestie.
Who I talked to one time at a party. But actually, no, I've interviewed her several times because she directed several episodes of Halt and Catch Fire, which I wrote about a lot.
She came on this pod for Fight Club.
She did. Yeah. Wonderful, wonderful director. But like she has a similar thing. She makes this breakthrough Sundance movie. Then she makes a studio movie that bombs. And then she has to like scrap and scrape for every single thing she does. And she just does a lot of TV. She at least can sort of go back into that genre lane where she can, she could probably always get a low budget horror movie made, but she has like bigger ambitions than just making a Blumhouse thing every few years.
I think it also, go ahead, Chandler.
There's this really great documentary called Half the Picture that's sort of like a discussion of female directors and sort of the gaps and what happens to so many of these directors. And they interview a lot of, female directors, especially from this time. So I think that was like my first exposure actually to Alison Anders, because this was kind of like a movie they kept citing over and over again, like The Promise of Gas Food Lodging. What happened?
Yeah.
Where was the career, you know, that she was supposed to be promised, you know?
Well, so much of it is also, obviously I'm not the first person to say this, but
Susan Seidelman's another one too.
Yes. I do think that it's part of this endemic kind of female directors only get one chance, right? Like if you fuck up once after the quote unquote breakthrough, you're toast. Men get a whole bunch of opportunities to fuck around and to, you know, to fall on their faces.
Yeah. You don't get to make your book of Henry and then, you know,
no, you make one book of Henry as a female, you're toast. But it's, yeah, I mean, it is just one of those things. And I sort of mentioned this earlier, but one of the things that I loved about this film was how all these characters are kind of fringy. Like they're all kind of specifically in this very kind of vibe of like, when I think about the, obviously you mentioned this on your Letterboxd review, but Robert, is it Knepper? Is that
Robert Knepper? Robert Knepper. This movie's like, what if Robert, this movie is probably the time most people are introduced. Anyone is introduced to Robert Knepper, and he is introduced as a sex symbol, which knowing him entirely through his career after this movie, I found baffling, but I also was like, you know, it kind of works.
It works. He's kind of hot in this. Didn't he? He plays Dank.
Hot Knep.
and also the other character, the oh my god, why am I forgetting the name of the, I mean, alluded to sort of gay friend of hers, Darius. Beautiful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Who's amazing. They all kind of exist in this very interesting little kind of just the look. Almost immediately when I pressed play on this, I was like, I'm all about Fruzabalk's look in this movie.
There's so many clothes I wanted. But it also felt like it was kind of this like 90s subculture, like the, you know, the fact that Jay Mascis does the score.
Yes. And acts in it too.
Yeah. At the very end. I really wanted to make a joke about, you know, Dank and how he was researching caves in Laramie before he died.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of into Dank's vibe. He's got like this, you know, I don't really know how to explain it, but like the hat and the leather jacket and the UV lights, and he likes looking at rocks. And he's just like this. I'll say this. The kissing between him and Ione Sky is
so gross.
Weird and so awkward. Yeah.
That was the weirdest, most poetic sex scenes in a cave I've ever seen. And I don't
put that on the video cassette.
I don't think I liked it.
No, I don't think
I'm glad it finally made her feel something.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah. I feel like if like Satan came into this podcast right now in Stay Tuned style and was like, Phil, you have to live in a movie, and then it was Gas Food Lodging and you got to be Dank, you'd be like, yeah, I can fuck with this.
I could roll with that. Fine. I mean, I don't particularly love him being crushed to death in a cave or a well or
I'd get you out before that. I'd figure out how to get you out of the movie.
I'm game with that. He's just
he wasn't,
he's got a vibe that I was just like, when he showed up, I was like, this guy's mysterious and interesting, and I'm kind of into it. Like, I get it.
The thing about go ahead.
Oh, like the cable repair man. That's just
the satellite guy.
Like, the whole movie is, I found the movie actually weirdly like predatory. Like, there's just all these like weird guys that are kind of like scheming around and just like always sort of lurking in the background. Like, there's no scenes where these women are allowed to be alone for more than like 30 seconds before some guy's pulling over or like making a comment, or they're passing some strange kooky guy. Like, every man is either gonna like harass them, or they're gonna have sex with them, or they're gonna pin some kind of unfulfilled hopes and longing onto them. It's a really, like, it does not pass the Bechdel test. It's not a feminist movie. Like, I don't know. It is, it isn't. It's interesting.
I think it is a feminist movie in the sense of, it is like talking about the ways in which it is difficult to be a woman under patriarchy, but especially for its era, when like it was saying, look, wouldn't it suck to just have guys constantly like objectifying you like this? And like most other movies are like, women, prepare to be objectified. You're going to have a great time.
I think that's what's so interesting about the Ione Sky character, is that it's kind of like, I mean, she has that really beautifully performed monologue where she kind of is like, you know, basically like, I just make myself into an object now because it's already happened to me. Like, I've already kind of been assaulted and degraded. So now I just kind of almost willingly play into this construct of what they want me to be and how I want to be seen. And that's sort of, it's interesting how that gets ruptured, but then I like how at the end she kind of doesn't change at the same time. It's
interesting because to hear both of you talk about this, because like I felt like the three female leads are all sort of in the headspace of, I don't need a man to complete me in just different kind of ways. It's not to say that, like, I mean, Nora obviously enjoys the companionship, and I think also, you know, just sort of the security that comes with it. But at the same time, she is keeping basically all the men in her life at arm's length for, you know, you've got Trudy, who the Ione Sky character, who has had this horrible trauma that happened to her in the form of this rape that's how she lost her virginity. And that obviously looms large in her perception of men. And then Firouza Balk, Shade's character, it's like she feels like she's supposed to have a boyfriend, or that she's supposed to long for boys. And she projects that onto obviously a boy that unfortunately is not receptive to her advances.
Oh, we've all been there.
We've all been there. It's just, it is interesting to me because like, it's not binary, and I appreciated that about the movie, you know?
I fucking love Trudy. She was like, if you're gonna pick an Emily character, it's like that's I've always, like, every time Ione Sky's in a thing, I'm like, well, that's me, that's who I am.
Yeah. I was thinking about like how it's such a different character than Diane Court in,
oh my god, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Or like she plays the kind of farcical mother of Mae Whitman on Arrested Development, and that's but every time I see her, I'm like, of course, that's sure. who I am. But I just
she's like such an underrated actress.
She's really great. Yeah.
I really responded to this movie in terms of talking about like rural working class environments, which is, you know, I grew up with money, but I grew up in a very small town in a very rural area. And there was this girl I knew in high school who basically told me the story Ione Sky tells about was in a similar situation where she was sexually assaulted. It was really terrible. And she tells it in that same tone of voice of like, well, this thing happened and I can't take it back. And now I just have to live with it, in the sense of like, what a weird way to lose my virginity. And like, there's this depth of pain underneath it that like this movie taps into, that I also think it captures the way that it's like, when you're in this environment, you kind of have to learn to just live with it in a way that is really destructive to yourself and your psyche. And like, I really responded to the Trudy section of this movie for that reason.
I think it's also interesting how she sort of the self-awareness of it. Do you know what I mean? Like, this is just a complete, like, I know what I'm doing. I'm controlling the situation. I am in power in the situation, for lack of a better way of putting it. And yet at the same time, I was a little surprised. I mean, spoiler, but like, that she kept the kid. You know,
no, she gave it up for adoption at the end.
Oh, right. You're totally right. I mean, I guess I'm surprised she went to term with the child, I guess is the better way of putting it. I was a little surprised, but also that she thinks she's going to be a model.
She looks like Ione Sky.
She
does look like Ione Sky.
That's like the most believable thing in this movie. That she
and her like horrible new friend that she's like, she's really
God, her roommate. Ugh. Awful. But Emily, I do think to your point, just sort of this reclamation of her body, of sort of, I'm in control of the situation because I had this horrible thing that was outside of my control happen. I thought was really well mined. I mean, I thought it was really well acted. I don't think that it was, again, this movie is just not, like, I just think it's really nuanced and subtle. Like, I just don't think that this movie is interested in sort of banging you over the head with shit.
I'm also like interested in the fact that it's based on a book by Richard Peck, who's this like really interesting figure of American children's literature. This is based on a kid's book, which I don't think you would expect.
Really?
Yes. The novel is from the perspective of Fruza Bulk's character. And it is like about this 16-year-old girl seeing her older sister get pregnant and watching her single mother try to like keep them alive on a waitress salary. Like, it's all in there, but Anders has shifted the perspective so much more to Trudy and the mom. Mm. And it's just like, you know, obviously Fruza Balk's still in there, but it's like that's not what the center of the film is anymore. And I think it is a really kind of gutsy choice to take. Richard Peck is a giant of American kids literature, but like, this is not one of his better known books, but still that name carries weight, to take that and be like, I'm going to do a total perspective flip on that. But I think what she responded to, and it was one of the reasons Peck became so well known, is he writes about the working class experience in a field where a lot of people don't. And I'm sure that's what she saw. I'm sure she was like, because she grew up in rural Kentucky. So like, she was like, living in that environment as well. So I'm sure she saw that and was like, this is a story I can tell. And now it's based on a book. So it's IP, which they probably didn't care as much about back then. But you know what? I'm just assuming that she went in and got this green. Like, she was like, I got a great piece of IP for you.
I mean, I do think, from what I read anyway, that there was a fair amount of Alison Anders in Shade's story and in Trudy's story to some degree. I didn't know that I didn't know it was a kid's book. And the book is called Don't Look and It Won't Hurt.
Yeah. And I think now we'd probably classify it as YA, but back then we were not as nuanced. They all just got kind of smushed together, like in the same category of, now you're done reading picture books, it's okay to read this book about a 16-year-old girl whose sister gets pregnant.
I mean, just for a second, I want to talk about Fruza Balk, because who I think is fantastic in this movie. She's talked a lot about how this is her favorite film that she's made of hers, and how close this character was to her heart. I was looking at her filmography, and I'm kind of surprised. Like, where did she go? It's odd to me.
Are you curious that a woman in Hollywood has had trouble finding roles after, say, the age of 35?
As a product of like Weinstein's 90s, you know, culture. Well,
I don't mean to, I'm certainly not suggesting that it's easy for people to get roles and what have you. But I do feel like, you know, she's in Almost Famous. She's nominated for a SAG award. I mean, it's part of the cast, but still. She gets a, you know. I'm sorry?
She's running and she's like, William, I have to tell you, your mom called. And then she just hits the wall.
It's the wall. She's great. She's in American History X. She's in The Waterboy. Like, she's in stuff in the late 90s, early 2000s. But then she kind of just disappears. And I don't know if it's just that it was just tricky for her. I don't know her personal life, so I don't want to guess. But she was also apparently in a Sopranos episode, but it was the original airing only. All the scenes were replaced. Do you know what that means?
I didn't. Oh, right. I think they recast that character later. So like,
oh, is she the character? She's the agent that infiltrates with Adriana.
Because I think that they were like, now this needs, like, they probably were like, this needs to be a recurring character. And either she didn't want to do that, or they couldn't afford her, or some combination of the two.
Interesting.
I'm very excited to see that she was the narrator for the animated version of The Skull, which is a wonderful children's book to bring us back to, like, everything. Yeah.
She's also a voice in Grand Theft Auto Vice City. So,
hey, good for her.
That feels like she's due for her Yellow Jackets moment.
I mean, listen, seriously, Emily, make it happen. Come on now.
Well, as we all know, I do all the casting on Yellow Jackets.
I know. But I think Chandler is very much on point, though. She would be a great 90s face to show up on
Yellow
Jackets.
Yeah.
It feels like this character is so against what you think of Fairuza Balk as being. Like, you always, I feel like we think of her as this very like quirky character actor, kind of intense and expressive, and she's just such a, like, she's so good at being like kind of an observer in this movie. Like, it's a really understated, quiet, super empathic performance, and it's all like in her eyes, and you know, she's just taking stuff in and really kind of a surrogate for the audience, and I feel like a surrogate for Allison Anders too.
Absolutely. I also feel like no one looks like her. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, Fairuza Balk is just has amazing. Such a look of her own. It's just awesome. Yeah.
But it's like, it's almost like as you're watching the movie, she kind of grows into her own face. Mm-hmm. Too. Like, she looks so young. Maybe they shot it over a couple months or something.
What were we going to say, Emma?
Can you imagine if I like ran into the Yellow Jackets room tomorrow and I was like, here's a pitch. There's a second adult Shauna. She's Fairuza Balk. We got to tear up everything we have. It's a Summersby. It's a Summersby riff.
I do think, though,
can't Shauna have a long lost cousin or something?
I mean,
who was also in the wilderness? We find.
Yeah, they did.
I mean, the whole cast of
the wing.
I feel like the whole cast of The Craft should be on Yellow Jackets.
Yeah, 100%. If I was casting, I would just like be like, who was in Cruel Intentions? Okay, who was in Jawbreaker?
What's for who was in Clueless?
When I was just a fan of the show before I worked on it, I was so hoping they would get Neve Campbell for something, because she's my girl. She was like, she was the girl I wanted to be at that age. And but you know, they never have, and that's fine. It's okay, but I'm
it
just
seems
saying
okay.
if there's
seems
a
like
second
okay
adult, if there's a third adult Shauna, that could be Neve Campbell.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Sure.
I was very happy with Lauren Ambrose. That was exciting.
Yes, I love Lauren Ambrose, obviously. And speaking of Lauren Ambrose, the character that plays Javier in this, Jacob Vargas, has an amazing episode of Six Feet Under that he's in the first season. Great actor and just wonderful. Yeah. I also feel like Fairuza Balk and Ione Skye both being in this movie is interesting just in its own right, because like Ione Skye also is a career that sort of never really took off. Like it's she's in stuff, it's in kind of fits and starts, but like Say Anything, which Chandler, you came on podcast like it's 1989 to talk about, she's obviously amazing in that. Her first role is in River's Edge, then she's in Say Anything in the Rachel Papers in 89, And she's in Gas Food Lodging, Wayne's World, a movie called Gun Crazy, which I've never heard of, but I guess that's also a movie that came out in 1992. And then it's like, I forgot she's in But I'm a Cheerleader.
Oh, yeah.
She has a bit part in that. She's great in Zodiac as the woman whose baby is thrown out a window or something like that.
Threatened with that.
Threatened to throw it out the window. Sorry. Yeah, it's just sort of, she's in a bunch of shorts. I don't know. It just kind of, it's just, it is what it is. I don't
know. As we know, she's fantastic in The Santa Incident with Greg German.
What that is, but you should know.
It's a 2010 film about the military shooting down Santa.
Stop it. Wow.
Great. Wonderful. No, you know what? I can say this as a bisexual woman. I can say this.
Sure.
She's got it. She's a good looking lady. She's got it.
She's the hottest woman that's ever lived. I mean, she's so beautiful in Say Anything. There's like one shot of her. She's wearing this like blue tank top and her hair is all like curly and long. And you're just like, how is a woman this beautiful? Like, I've never seen this before. And in this movie too, I mean, she's so stunning. It's heartbreaking to look at her.
I first saw Say Anything in like 98, 99. And there was like a girl I had a crush on at that time. And I was like, she looks just like Ione Sky. And if I pulled up a photo of that girl for you now, you'd be like, really? Emily? But love makes you see what you want to see.
Whatever you want to see. She was
like, to be clear, she was a very pretty girl. Like, she was very, but she was no Ione Sky. You know?
Ione Sky.
I don't know if you guys know this, but where did the name I've never seen Ione before.
What a
it's
good
the
name.
Only Ione I've ever known.
Should I change my name to Ione?
I think you might.
Oh, you Ione.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's an amazing name. And then
you were going to ask what La Brea is about, and I was like, I don't know anymore, but they're still on. So
it's getting wrapped up. La Brea is about the La Brea Tar Pits opening up a hole to the center of the earth.
It is one of those shows that I'm constantly like, I just think I should just have this on while I'm doing other things.
You should always have it on. It seems like an Emily show. The other actress in this movie is Brooke Adams, who is best known for Days of Heaven.
Fucking love Brooke Adams. Days of Heaven. That's one of my
Body Snatchers, Dead Zone.
Yeah.
Married to Tony Shalhoub, something I didn't know.
Yeah. Good for Monk.
Yeah. They got married in 1992. Maybe we should do an episode about their wedding.
Let's have them both on. Let's just be like, hey, how was your
92 like?
And then it'll be like a sneak attack. We'll be like, surprise, this episode's about Beethoven. And then they'll have to talk about Beethoven, even though
find someone for Beethoven, Emily.
It's going to happen. It's going to happen.
What was that, Chandler?
Shalhoub and Brooke.
Shalhoub and Brooke for Beethoven? No one would know what to do with that episode.
This is the thing, is Beethoven's going to be our 92 finale. I've already said that. Guest is going to blow your mind. It's going to blow your mind.
You set the bar so high, Emily. The thing is, I actually texted you about someone. I was like, we should get so-and-so to be on. You're like, yeah, no, I'm not reaching out to that person on Twitter.
It's a person it would be amazing to have on our podcast who I have a contact with, who I'm like friendly with, who probably would agree to come on this podcast if I asked them at the right moment in time. And to be clear, I am friendly with Lin-Manuel Miranda, and this is not Lin-Manuel Miranda. I just am like, I would be too embarrassed to email this person about Beethoven.
It would be amazing. I think they and us would have the greatest time. But
they also have a very famous spouse. So I've been like, what if you?
Oh my god! If we got them both,
came on to talk Beethoven.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank.
LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'll tell you off mic, Chandler, who this person is, but it would be amazing. But to get back to gas food lodging, I have a question for both of you, and I don't want to sound like an idiot here, but
food,
am I
gas then lodging? Go ahead.
Sorry. Yes. Yeah. Gas food lodging.
That's my ranking.
Fuck, Mary, kill, gas.
I believe it's Alvia Rivero, I believe is the character's name. This movie, mm-hmm. This Spanish Mexican movie star. Am I missing something? What is this saying? Like, is there a subtextual thing about shade that I'm missing? And I don't mean that to sound, you know, pedantic. I'm just like, is there something kind of, I liked it as a device, but I did find myself just wondering, like, what exactly it's speaking to in Shade's character.
Do you think,
I don't know if you guys found it.
Her relationship at the end?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, all it is sort of like a moniker for her to be like, oh, this new guy is actually, this Hamlet is his name. Hamlet's not that bad. He likes this movie star that I like. But that's a long way to get there.
I do think there's something in it about the ways in which when you are in a situation like this, like movies can be one of your few escape routes. Also, you know, you will look for yourself in films and not always find yourself in people who look exactly like you, especially when you are, a woman or a person of color or a queer person. You often have to like glom onto people who are not exactly like you in every particular, just because that's how the movies work. But I do think it literally is just like Allison Anders thought it would be neat.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and it's also, it's like originally shot for the movie, so it's not like she was
a real
thing, rice. Yeah.
I do think that, you know, the movie sort of starts with us seeing Shade. She's watching these old movies and what have you, and we meet Nora. She's a waitress. She has these two daughters. We learn this sort of Trudy's skipping school and she quits school to be a waitress at this diner with her. And then she's dating, or she thinks she's dating this. I guess he's like, he looks like an athlete. I think he's got like a letter jacket at one point. But he's just cheating on his girlfriend with her. So she kind of gets dumped and she kind of lands in the arms of Dank, this,
If only we could all land in the arms of Dank.
A British patrologist? Is that
how
you say it?
Is Robert Knepper British? Let's find out. I should have researched this before recording.
He's strange if he wasn't.
He's American, born in Fremont, Ohio.
I bought it.
He's been married to Nathan Tennant Carey since 2013.
Really?
So,
yeah. Doesn't he have like a David Tennant-y vibe, don't you think?
Yeah.
In this?
Yeah. I think he's kind of like, he's like a David Tennant, but for like serial killers. Does that make sense? And I think of serial killers, obviously there are serial killers the world over, but I think of them as an American phenomenon. So that makes me feel like, yeah, he's like Doc. He's like if the Doctor was a serial killer.
I think that's the right. He feels like a kind of skeezy, creepy version of David Tennant.
Can I tell a rather long-winded Robert Knepper story that I promise?
When else would you have this chance?
I mean, you never know.
Yeah.
You never know. He made Where the Day Takes You in 1992 and Tequila and Bonetti, the TV series.
Sure.
So
was he Tequila or Bonetti?
Let's find out. He was Phillips. So, So when I was living in when I first moved to California, I moved to a town called Riverside, which is like an hour inland from Los Angeles, the worst place on the planet.
It's not
just
great.
To be clear, not a fun place to be. I got a job at the newspaper there because I was very much like, well, I can't move anywhere unless I have a job. And like, I was good at my job, but I was like not devoting nearly as much of my attention to it as my employers would have liked. What I really wanted to do was write for television or write TV criticism. So I started this blog called South Dakota Dark, which like was kind of my entry into both of these things. I met a lot of people through that blog who have helped my career along the way. But when I started out that blog, I was so desperate to see the new fall TV shows.
Sure.
And I couldn't, because I was nobody. I couldn't get like press accreditation. I couldn't get anybody to send me stuff. And then my wife read about this thing that was called like New TV Preview, and they were like, come see new shows that are coming to your television and you can watch them. And it sounded like basically they were going to have you do test audience stuff. And so I go to this like hotel, like at the edge of Riverside. I go into their like conference center. I go in, I sit down, they hand me this like sheet of paper and they're like, please fill this out. It's just like a bunch of questions about brands. It's like, which brands do you like? And I was like, oh, this is like an advertising thing. They're going to show me the new shows, but they're going to have ads in them. That's fine. They start the show. And it is a, do you remember when they would be like pilot? I can't remember what they're called, but they shot like basically like key scenes from the pilot, but not the full thing. A presentation. This is very popular in the late 90s. So there's a pilot presentation that is about two souls bound together by true love and the depths of passion across the reaches of time. They've been reincarnated over and over, and they start remembering their past lives when they run into each other in late 90s America. They're remembering when they lived in like World War II era, and then the implications they're going to remember more and more. And I was like, this has not been made recently. This was made in like 1997, because the romantic leads of it were Kim Raver, who's, you know, fine as, but then, and Robert Knepper. And it was like, look at this man, the most beautiful, wonderful man ever existed. And then the other pilot was the Valerie Harper show City, which was co-created by Paul Haggis, ran one season on CBS in the 90s. And they were like, people are excited to bring this show back. That's what's happening now. We're going to bring back a one season CBS show.
Why did they give these shows to you?
Because that was the shows that they had, like, and they had us all sit in a room and we watched them. And the ads came up in the middle of them. And then you had to write down what you thought about the ads at the end. It was the worst thing I've ever done. And for a long time, the most popular post on my website, South Dakota Dark, was people searching for this thing because they did it all over the country and being like, what the fuck just happened to me? And like, then they would like find my post and they would post in the comments, I had to watch this fucking shit too. Robert Knepper, no.
I do feel like it's necessary, since we've spoken of Robert Knepper a pretty significant amount here. It's worth noting.
I do love him most of the time. He just is like, this is the one time I've been like, he's sexy.
He was on Prison Break for a long time. He was on Heroes. He was on iZombie. He was on the revival of Twin Peaks. He's been in a bunch of stuff. If our listeners Google Robert Knepper, and you'll see that he has like 8 million credits. He's been in a million things. But this is the only time he's sexy. So
he was got on that. He was on Carnival, a show that we've talked about on this show.
Great
show. But Phil, you didn't say what his character name was on Prison Break.
What was it?
Teabag.
Yeah, I never watched Prison Break. It wasn't my
He was like, that was the era of you could do a show where there was like just a guy and they're like, this guy's an unrepentant white nationalist and child molester and he's one of the good guys. And like, that was
Taylor, Teabag. Did you watch Prison Break?
I can't say that I have, unfortunately.
So I do think one of my favorite lines in this movie is from Nora, where we discover that Nora is having an affair with this. Do we find out what the other guy does? Forgive me, the guy that she's having an affair with. God, what's his name? Anyway, it doesn't.
The guy that's like the sort of cowboyish.
Yeah, the cowboy character. Yeah,
like, he's like, you should date this guy, and then he comes over for dinner.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Yeah. That comes out of nowhere. But I do.
My dad was like, who is that?
Looks familiar. He's been in a lot of stuff.
I think it's Chris Cooper, but then it wasn't.
It was not Chris Cooper. But she's in her car and he's talking to her and it's clear that like he wants to go out with her again. And she's trying to kind of rebuff him. And she says, women are lonely in the 90s. It's our new phase. We'll live. Which I think is a great line. It just goes to show that she's just like, I don't need you. And this isn't worth it to me. Then there's this great line that Darius has to Shade, where he says, the way I see it, chicks are the ones who want to go to outer space. That's why they push so hard. Like this idea that he sees women as these like badasses that are just like pushing the form and just trying to do all these crazy things. And it's interesting because like later in the film, when erroneously Trudy tells Shade to dress up like Olivia Newton-John, and that will somehow make Darius fall in love with her or whatever, you sort of see this, like, unbeknownst to him, he's sort of kind of given Shade this confidence and this like desire to kind of push herself. It's just unfortunate that he's weirdly kind of pushed her towards him, if you know what I'm saying.
Two things. Are you thinking of the actor Chris Mulkey? I think you might.
Yes,
be.
I am thinking of him.
He has been in his IMDb credits on his IMDb credits number in the 260s. He has 13 upcoming projects. If you look at the photos of him, one of them is a photo of a country album he recorded with the actor William Shockley, under the act's name was Mulkey and Shockley, which is like not a fun thing to say, Mulkey and Shockley.
It
Mulkey
doesn't feel Shockley, good in your Mulkey mouth at Shockley. All.
The other thing I wanted to mention is I noticed how quickly you moved past Prison Break talk, because you were like, if I let Emily sit here, we're going to be on this for 10 minutes.
We're going to be here forever, and Chandler hasn't watched the show and neither have I. So
That happens on Prison Break.
I don't want to know anything. I think that the Trudy Dank stuff in the car when they're driving and you get that Nick Cave needle drop, which is great, and he turns on the UV light and it makes everything glow and is cool. But sure. Then like the sex scene, as you alluded to, Chandler, is with all the fucking like phosphorescent rocks.
It's kind of cool. She is like, I present my breasts to you in this rock light. I liked it, actually. I thought it was kind of charged and like interesting and like really going for it and kind of strange.
I'm going to stand up for that scene, too. I thought it was kind of hot. Like, it wasn't the hottest sex scene I've ever seen, but it definitely when you see her breasts, it doesn't feel like they're just there to ogle them. It feels like they are there to act as a subject of sexual pleasure, which is so rare. So rarely happens on screen.
Yeah,
and also it's like all the cool glowing rocks. So,
and there's like some cool superimpositions, like crossfades and mascus.
Yeah, and like there's things falling. There's like weird,
that was really interesting. I was like, what is that? But I guess it did really feel like this is a woman behind this sex scene, you know, like,
yes,
this is,
yeah,
which I appreciate. Like the female gaze is really real in that.
If a British man named Dank called me down into a cave and was like, you know what, I'm going to just like, it's going to be like when Indiana Jones is like trying to measure out the bag of sand.
Sure. Sure.
I'd be so overcome.
Do you think that the sex scene in this movie is better or worse than Damage, Emily?
Oh, it's so much better. Oh, my God.
Have you seen Damage, Chandler?
I don't know what that is.
Chandler, you got to just go on YouTube, search for the sex scenes from the movie Damage. I don't want to assume anything about your sexuality, but if you are heterosexual, I am sorry. It will make you no longer heterosexual. It's that bad.
It is Jeremy Irons and Juliette Binoche having sex in a Louis Malle film, and she's flailing her arms around in this very strange way.
Girl style, kind of?
Sure.
Have you seen the film Being John Malkovich?
I have. I love that.
It's exactly like John Cusack's puppets in that movie. That is how they have sex.
It's very strange.
Oh, that sounds great.
Oh, it's great.
So I have to see it.
It's great. I love after Shade is rejected by Darius and she's sitting on the curb in all decked out in her quote unquote Olivia Newton-John outfit. And Javier comes up to her and says, "Hey, movie girl, no movies today, huh? Just real life." It kind of was a burn, but I kind of liked it. It was like, I don't know. I enjoyed it.
This movie just gets this environment, this like yes. environment yeah. of like rural America, kind of dead end. Anybody who wants anything outside of what they already have is suspected of not being, you know, of not thinking this is good enough. This is a milieu I love and know so well. And we talked about a little bit on our country music episode, and it's so rarely represented well on television or in film or in literature. And yet here it is. Gas Food Lodging handles it just about perfectly. I'm going to bump it up a couple points at the end. Just you wait and see.
A racist friend at the party where she's like, very strange DJs come
and that try to basically rape her in the kitchen.
Yeah, and then like Javier is there, but then she's like, he's like, "Get out of here." And I was like, this person just seems terrible. They seem like the worst person in the world.
The movie's relationship to race is the one thing that is like, I understand what it's going for, but it also is like, A, it's aged very poorly, and B, it's also kind of like, I understand what it's going for. It just maybe didn't need to make that point as much as it does, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think if I'm gonna ding this movie for one thing, the kid crowd scenes, like the kid group scenes, aren't very well done. Like this movie obviously has a lot of, you know, static wide shots for the most part, and is just kind of letting things play out. But that requires obviously blocking and making sure that all of the interactions are going well. And if you have nothing to cut to, it just feels very static and very kind of forced and stilted. And I do think that the kid scenes and like whenever they're outside the diner, all those kind of moments with Trudy and all the kind of like asshole frat boys, that stuff just doesn't work.
The dialogue is pretty
rough.
It needs to be way more specific and just feels kind of really on the nose. And
yeah, no, I totally
agree. Kind of borderline, like not even humiliating to the characters, but just like it's in a worse movie than the movie that we're watching.
I totally agree. I think that you mentioned this earlier, Chandler, the sort of date setup where Shade sets up, unbeknownst to her, sets up her mom and this guy she's already has had an affair with on this like date in their house, and it's super awkward and whatnot. I thought it kind of came out of nowhere. I didn't really love it, but what I did like was the scene after, the messiness of the date resolving itself and kind of that lovely parting of ways between Nora and, forgive me, but whatever the character's name is. I thought it was just really like, again, there's this really lovely, nuanced believability in so much of the film that when you do find those moments of unbelievability, they just stick out that much more.
Yeah. And Josh Brolin is her real dad. That kind of is this weird deus ex machina that just is like, "Hi, I'm your dad.
I love that. I love that, honestly. Genuinely.
Her impression of Josh Brolin or just
like I loved him coming in and being like, "Here I am, I'm your dad." Like that is, again, a thing that I think captures something from this sort of space in life. And then like he can't actually really solve anything.
Yeah.
And so he just leaves the movie to marry Barbara Streisand.
They meet this year.
Good for him. Oh, well, good for them.
Good for them.
He does give her money to buy her sister a nightgown, which I assume was maybe supposed to be an abortion or something. But anyways,
Josh Brolin is a guy who, quite frankly, all I really know him from is Governor Ritchie from The West Wing. So, like, I don't actually really know Josh Brolin as an actor. I know he is something. Obviously, I looked up his credits. He's been in a whole bunch of movies. The scene that I think works incredibly well is the scene when Shade goes over to his house and asks for the money. Mm-hmm. And then you have this fight that's going on behind closed doors.
Yeah.
Where his new wife is basically like, "We don't have $50 to give her. Like $50 is blood money. Like we don't have them." And that idea of just how hard money is to come by for these characters is just really, really well done. And then for him to give her the money in the car afterwards, and it's like, see, I'm a good dad. I wrestled together $50 to give you, is just kind of just really sad. Just it's in a just very believable way. There's another scene earlier that I want to talk about very quickly, which is after Nora and Hamlet have sex, Hamlet apologizing for the fact that he clearly couldn't make Nora climax, and her being like, no, it's fine. It's fine. It was lovely. It was fine. And then her talking about how getting used to a man helps her relax, and like all sort of this.
I thought that was really beautiful.
I did too. I really loved it. I loved how comfortable she is with her own body and an understanding of her own body, understanding of what makes sex pleasurable for her. I don't know. I thought that scene was just really, really, really well done.
I'm trying to find an obscure Chris Mulkey movie so I can stream it, because it sounds like extremely my shit. You go to Chris Mulkey's IMDb page and he's got the little video that plays as his reel. That man's hustling. You got to give him credit.
No, sure. He's big 250 credits. Yeah.
The character he plays in this film, by the way, is named Raymond. So there you go. Okay.
Well, I think it's just generally like, you know, class in American movies, especially in the coming of age, like teen movie space, is rarely discussed in any way, you know, and it's kind of always assumed, I think, in teen movies that like those characters are going to be kind of solidly middle class or upper middle class or something. So it is refreshing to see how many like contemporary American films are set in sort of like trailer parks and kind of in a lower middle class milieu, and single mother working households, and kind of it is pretty remarkable, and you don't even see that today at all.
I'd like the girl who told me the story that was so similar to the Oni Sky story, like she, you know, she had a sister and she had a brother, and like she had that this like her parents, you know, were constantly kind of trying to scrape to get by. Her parents didn't really seem like they loved each other anymore, but they like had to kind of stay together to keep insurance and all these things, and it was just like, yeah, you don't see that. You know, there's the movie, like the one I always turn to is Booksmart, which I think is a fun movie, but it's very much like, oh, none of these people have ever experienced financial hardship once. And I love when a movie goes out of its way to be like, okay, yeah, like class exists and these people exist within that system, especially a teen movie. Because I feel like when you're a teenager is when you really start to like get that knowledge.
I think that's one of the things that honestly makes John Hughes movies hold up as well as they do. In some parts, they don't hold up, but in a lot of ways, they do.
Especially.
Sorry?
Oh, Pretty in Pink, especially.
Pretty in Pink, and Breakfast Club also has that to some degree. Yeah. I think that he, you know, the class distinctions are a thing that I think kids don't really recognize until they have to recognize them, if that makes sense. And I think that those movies, when they do grapple with them, I think do a really good job.
I mean, if you do a Marxist analysis of Baby's Day Out, you get a lot out of it.
That baby, he gets it. Or she, baby, I don't even know.
That baby is the proletariat. And like that, you could take that to the bank.
But I do think, though, to wrap this up in terms of how the film kind of resolves itself, Shade and Javier, them falling in love, and that kind of cross-section of, I mean, their first kiss is so lovely, the way that, like, and it's like really charged in a beautiful way, the way he keeps like kissing her cheeks over and over again, and just sort of there when they're walking around in the rocks together, and just there's something very kind of first love, but not in a super cheesy way. I really appreciated that. I also think that, you know, from the second that they have their sort of fight at the beginning together, you know that these two are obviously like, you know, barreling towards each other, but it's not done in a shitty, hackneyed way. I love the scene with his deaf mom dancing with the vibrations. It's just really, really lovely stuff. Like the movie's just really, just really well done. Then Trudy gets pregnant with Dank's kid. Dank doesn't come back. She feels like she's been left. And then she moves to Dallas to have the kid. And then at the end, we find out via the... was he the lead singer of Dinosaur Jr.?
Yeah, he's like the guitar player. And
yeah. in a performance that I was like, this has to be someone, right? Because there's no way that this person gets this role otherwise.
Yeah, what is his name? He has some like outlandish name.
Oh, the character in the movie? Yeah. It's fantastic. It's Cecil.
He's like, no, I'm not Dank. I'm Cecil.
And he proceeds to tell us about how Dank was crushed in
rocks before he died.
It is delivered similarly to the line in the trailer for Madame Web. and then we're left basically. Shade finds out that Dank died and that he didn't just leave Trudy, and that someday she'll tell her. That's the end of the movie. I'm just like, I love the fact that she doesn't. She's like, yeah, fuck, whatever. I'll get around to it. I'll tell her. I'll tell Trudy when I feel like.
Fair enough.
It's fantastic. Yeah, I mean, it's I don't know. I this movie was kind of not what I was expecting. I'd seen the poster so many times. I had seen clips from it in my brain at like 12 and 13 years old. I didn't really know what I was in for. And I really liked it. It's I don't know. I love that one of the things that we get to do in this podcast is these smaller movies. I know that Passion Fish was nominated for Oscars, but like still feels very intimate and very small. And I'm thrilled that we got to cover this. But yeah. Emily, do you have thoughts on Gas, Food, or Lodging?
Lodging made a big move up over Gas. our car addiction is killing the planet, but we got to eat and we got to sleep. So Food, Lodging, Gas, that's my rank.
I'm going to rank this film. I came into this at a 79, and I'm going to go up. I'm going to go up to an 85. I think that this movie is really good. I think that people should watch it. It is currently streaming on Tubi, I believe. Is that where you saw it, Emily? I think I watched it on Tubi.
I did. I watched it on Tubi, and then I have spent a wonderful hour scrolling what's available on Tubi. Fucking crazy.
It's crazy. Great. It's Pluto and Tubi, man. There's weird shit up there. It's great.
They gotta band together and become Pluby. It'll be great.
Emily, what's your rating on Gas, Food, and Lodging?
Is Pluby or Tudo better?
Tudo.
Tudo.
I like Pluby. Sounds like a Disney character.
As mentioned earlier, I came into this like an 82, and now Phil has leapt over me because I'm going to go up a little bit, but I'm only going up to an 84. I think it's I got it in that mid 80s range. I think it's a real, you know, it has some things about it I don't think quite work, but it's just a really well observed movie about this part of the country, being a woman in that part of the country, sure. And a whole bunch of other things. And it has hands down Robert Knepper's sexiest performance ever. I'm also going to go up on the queer phobia scale to a 3 because it is queer phobic that I do not get to date Dank.
You wouldn't.
What about you? Where are you at for Gas, Food, Lodging?
I think I'm at a 78. I felt like I kind of went into it expecting it was going to be like one of the most profound American independent films ever made, and
it wasn't. Yeah,
and I was like, this is really good, but you know, it doesn't like shock me to my core, you know. Sure. The way that other independent, I mean, I think it's a really competently well observed portrait of, you know, three ladies trying to make their way in New Mexico, falling in love with TV repairman and geologists, and I don't know,
sure.
Whoever comes their way. And I thought Fairuza Balk was really, that's like a star making performance when they talk about it. Yeah.
I'm curious if you've seen the film we're covering next week, Chandler. It's a little film called Ladybugs with Rodney Dangerfield. Have you seen this film?
I can't say that I have. It's a blank spot in my my education.
It is. I'm going to just read you the synopsis, which is literally two sentences. Desperate for success, girls football coach Chester finds a novel way to bolster his failing team. He includes his own stepson disguised as a girl.
Oh, boy.
Well, that's going to be a fun one.
I did not know that's what it was about, Emily. Did you?
I had an inkling in the back of my brain. I feel like the anti trans sports panic is very much based on people having seen Ladybugs.
Ladybugs.
Yeah, well, LaToya Ferguson's going to come on and talk with us about ladybugs.
I feel like we're going to have a nuanced discussion about gender.
Yeah, it's going to be great. I'm looking forward to it.
Brandis plays Martha / Matthew. Boy, oh boy. Oh, Vanessa Shaw's in it, though. I love Vanessa Shaw.
I like the boy, oh boy.
Oh my God, this movie ends with an entire team of spoilers. The entire girls softball team being replaced by boys disguised as girls, which is also the plot line of the Daily Wire's Lady Ballers, which is a terrible movie that was made as an anti-trans panic thing. We're going to have a great time
Ladybugs. This could be great. Chandler. Nothing
problematic there.
Please let me know if Ladybugs has kind of like a 12th night, like pseudo Shakespearean.
That would be amazing.
He's the man. Kind of quality to it. Remember,
what if Jonathan Brandis realizes what he wants to be as a girl? What if that's what Ladybugs is about? What if it's an early trans text?
It'd be interesting.
Probably right.
It was just about queer joy and Rodney Dangerfield.
What if Rodney Dangerfield experienced queer joy? What a movie.
Yeah.
I mean, Rodney Dangerfield was such a subtle comedian that I think this is probably going to be handled very delicately.
I don't know. I don't know what you're talking about. I'm experiencing queer joy. I get no respect, but I get joy. Is that good at all?
That's pretty good.
Yeah, that was really good. I was really impressed.
So Chandler, is there any way for anyone to watch your movie in the United States of America?
God, I hope so. I mean, when is this coming out?
Let's just say April.
Okay, hopefully by then I will be able to confidently say yes.
There's something in the works is what you're saying.
Yes. Or it will have already happened, you know.
That's amazing. I am so, so, so happy about that.
Yeah, but every day I'm just checking my email going, what's going
on?
It's
gonna be amazing. I can't speak highly enough about it.
Studio movie in the studio.
For all those Ladybugs fans out there, you should check out Chandler's movie.
We have this really great IP. It's called Ladybugs.
Can you imagine if I just walked into a studio tomorrow? I was like, I want to make a new spin on Ladybugs. They'd probably think about
it. Absolutely.
They would open their checkbooks.
Yeah, they'd be like, great. IP?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're like, IP, want. I mean, maybe you'll watch Ladybugs and maybe you'll think that there needs to be a queer joy. who's the modern Roddy Dangerfield, though?
Oh, boy, Tim Allen.
No. I mean, if you did Ladybugs with, like, I don't know, like Leslie Jones, for instance.
Okay.
Just like come at this from a completely different angle, Emily, and like just infuse it with. I really do think you could do this.
I'm going to make it a dark drama. It was written one draft, one outline of Yellow Jackets. Ladybugs.
Put in the cyber-terrorism somehow.
Oh, my God. Fantastic. Chandler, thank you so much for coming on here and talking about...
Lovely to talk to you both, and what a great movie. And, you know, justice for Allison Anders, I think...
Real, right?
Great. If, you know, I keep hearing about that Elaine May movie that's supposed to happen with Dakota Johnson. And
I mean, we'll see.
That'd be great if Allison Anders could make another film.
I think that the chances of Allison Anders making another movie are far higher than Elaine May making her movie. From everything I've read, it sounds like she's got very high demands. Let's just put it that way.
Oh yeah.
I'm not saying she should. But,
Do it.
Yeah.
But
Phil, I don't know the schedule. If we on April Fool's Day released an Enchanted April episode,
oh my God.
Would we do that? Sure, let's do it.
April Fool's, Enchanted April Fool's. It's great. It sounds there perfect.
We'll do a double feature with some other fucking movie.
I mean, listen, are you suggesting we do like a half an hour on Enchanted April and a half an hour on like something else and do April Fools?
Yeah, let's.
That's
do,
a good idea.
Like, yeah,
I think it's Enchanted April, but then it's something else at the beginning.
Let's do half an hour.
So we're playing a prank on our listeners. Is that what you're saying?
No, we're going to freely advertise that we're doing half an hour on Enchanted April and half an hour on Stop or My Mom Will Shoot.
Wait, but I want to come on for that episode because that's the screenwriter of Blank Check.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Oh my God. I actually, you know what? I saw Stop or My Mom Will Shoot with my grandmother in theaters when I was 12. I remember
that. Was so hyped for that movie. I still have never seen it. So
it's Stallone and Estelle Getty, right?
Correct. Yeah.
See, Emily's already laughing. It's
in blank. Yeah. Kind of a spiritual successor to Ladybugs, I hear. but I hear that, yeah, it's the guy in the Blank Check screenwriting book. He's always like, as my, you know, when I was really breaking down, stopping my mom. He just keeps citing this movie.
Oh my God.
It is Blake Snyder. Oh my God.
Yeah.
This is happening. Enchanted Mom Will Shoot.
Enchanted April of April. My Mom Will Shoot.
Yeah.
It's going to be great. Chandler, is there anything you'd like to plug?
Canadian film. The Canadian film industry.
Yeah. The Globe and Mail?
No, just everyone watch some Canadian movies. I think this winter. Check some out.
Maybe our best plug yet, Emily.
Was that a plug for the Canadian film industry?
Correct. Check some out.
Right.
Do you have any Canadian movies that came out in 1992?
That anyone's heard of. Are there any?
I'm taking that as a challenge. I actually, 1992.
Stopper, My Mom Will Shoot.
In Canada.
Well, I don't know if it was, and then you're going to find stuff filmed in Canada, but Canadian film.
List of Canadian films of 1992. Okay, this is a list of Canadian films which were released in 1992. Oh. Being at Home with Claude, of course.
I've never
the most Canadian sounding movie that's ever been.
It's like a fake movie. Like if like 30 Rock had to come up with the name of a Canadian movie.
Forbidden Love, The Unashamed Stories of Lesbian Lives.
Wow.
Let's see here.
You didn't want to be a fairy anymore.
Yeah, there's Leolo, which won a bunch of Canadian awards.
Okay. Yeah, Leolo is actually very good.
Did Adam Ogoya not have a 92 movie?
I don't believe he did.
I thought maybe Exotica came out, but maybe I was wrong.
I think it's 95 maybe or 94.
Oh, wow, not a lot of Canadian movies popping off. And
shockingly,
I got
92, not a great year for Canadian film.
I got to see what. Oh, you know what won? Mm. The Genie Award that year, which is a movie that I've heard of and is like directed by a seminal Canadian director, David Cronenberg's Naked Lunch. We could do that.
Oh shit. I didn't know that was 92. Is that really 92?
I mean, it won the Genie Award in 92. God knows when it came out in the US, probably like 2012, but
it might have come out in 2012. Nice. 1991.
Mm, yeah, it came out in 91 in Canada, but then it like won. Oh, it was released in the US in 91? What the
it
fuck?
It was. December 27th for Oscar consideration, you know, because they were going to go for that Naked Lunch shit.
It won the Genie Award in 1992. And then Leolo appears to also be...
It's what won in 1993, though? Because that'll be the 1992 movie.
Well, that's the thing about the Genies is they're in December for some reason. So who could fucking say? You know what won in 1993? Is 32 short films about Glenn Gould. On the other hand, that was actually released in 1993. So the Genie Awards are just letting me down all over the place.
Can we talk about the fact that Naked Lunch cost $20 million and made 2.6?
Oh, boy.
Wow. That's,
you know what? I think December 27th, 1991 is basically 1992.
It's basically 1992.
Yeah.
Oh, 100%.
All right, Chandler, I'm going to let you go to bed because it's late for you.
It
I
is
feel weird. Like we've kept you up talking about New Mexico and Robert Knepper and all sorts of things. But you're the best. You're going to come back for April Fool's episode. Probably not, but that's fine. And just because I feel like you're busy. But I'll certainly try to make it happen.
I think it would be so good if this released before, after the April Fool's episode and Chandler was on that. And it was like,
by the way, that seems
part one.
That seems like a very strong possibility.
I don't even know you guys April Fool's me. And you're like, you called. I have a horrible emergency.
This was all a prank on Chandler.
Just watch a stop for my mom will shoot. And then I'm like, okay. And then
we got Chandler to do a double bill of Enchanted April and Stop or My Mom Will Shoot just to see if we can.
What we would have to do is reach out and be like, okay, we're talking Stop or My Mom Will Shoot. And then you join the call and we're talking Enchanted April.
Yeah. Well, Enchanted April, like, I'm just so intrigued. Like, okay, what is it?
Yeah, what is it even about, Emily?
It's about April.
The poster. Oh, it's Jim Broadbent in it. That's a good sign.
It's a Mike Newell film, which is
And Alfred Molina.
Yeah, it was nominated for a bunch of... It's based on a novel. It was nominated for a bunch of
English awards. Women after World War One who are unhappy with their lives and their time away on go on vacation in a beautiful Italian villa. Well, that sounds nice.
This is a beautiful... This is like the exotic Best Marigold Hotel. Like, this is this is where that genre is born of. Here's some actresses.
Yeah. I mean, I'm looking at this.
Maybe someone will fuck Jim Broadbent in a cave.
That should be the bar.
Listen.
Anyone get fucked in a cave?
There's if you have not seen The Crying Game in a long time, there's an ambiguously queer Jim Broadbent in that movie, and he's wonderful.
Do you know that this film, that Enchanted April, won Best Film at the Cleveland International Film Festival?
I mean, of course.
I've been to the Cleveland International Film Festival. But I didn't win. Wow, but it got three nominations for three Golden Globes.
Yeah, it's nominated for three Oscars. I mean, listen, Enchanted April, I don't know what this movie's going to be, but it's going to be great. And
truly sounds like a fake movie that if you told me this, you made this up. It's the most.
Here's what's great. It's 95 minutes. So, you know, got that going for it. Stop or My Mom Will Shoot, though. I'm curious about that.
I think that's like 85.
It's 87 minutes with trailers and it made $70 million.
Hell yes.
Stop
or My Mom Will Go on an April trip with three of her elderly friends.
This movie might be great. I mean, it might be great. I don't know. The Washington Post called it your worst nightmare. All right. This feels like the right way to end this episode. Chandler, sleep well. Thank you again so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.